Welcome to the Port Forward Podcast.
Step into my world. I don't care if you've got much cash, if you're a boy or a girl. It's the way you wear your hair, your careless little smile. It's the way you dance with me until I'm spinning, 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 spinning,
guys. Ben here with Sam.
Sam here.
We're trying a novel recording technique using
two iPhones,
so we'll see what happens.
I'm also curious to know which one has better fidelity.
Well, we're going to have to figure out how to get the files off, which...
That's not a problem for me.
Okay, well, I'll just go through iTunes, but I don't know.
Well, since mine is jailbroken, I will just click and drag that shit.
Yeah, you'll click and drag. I'm jealous. Okay. So we haven't recorded for about a year, which is pretty impressive.
That's it?
That's the longest it's gone. I have no idea how many listeners we have, but share this with your friends, because I'm sure it'll be another year before we record again.
Certainly.
We got a couple beers here. We're hanging out on Wednesday. Actually, what's the date today? I don't have my phone.
October 8th.
It's October 8th. 4:20 p.m., ironically. But that was not on purpose. So, what's up, dude? You were telling me about a book or something?
Yeah, so I read this book called What Computers Can't Do, and it's written by a professor. I can't remember what college, but it was written in the 1950s. So, it was all about the state of artificial intelligence. Apparently, computers were very promising at the time, and everybody was saying that they could become chess champions.
Well, we did beat Big Blue... By the way, I read a book about Big Blue. It's nuts what he did, but the guy that built it...
Tell me. I'll be able to come back to my story.
Oh, well, I mean, basically, he built his own silicon, and he used this university program that'll spin silicon for you, because normally it's extremely expensive to do, mm-hmm. and so they have, like, all kinds of restrictions, and it's not, like, it's not, like, the most recent...
When you say spin silicon?
That means... You make your design, you make all your masks, and then you literally go to a plant somewhere, and they grow the silicon crystals, they slice them, they expose them all the chemicals, they dope them, they do all that, and you get back a chip.
Wow.
So part of that is the pins on the chip, on the outside are pins, on the inside they have pads on the silicon, mm-hmm. and what they do is they wire bond. So what that means is they basically... Actually, I don't know if it's pressure or heat or it's a thermal weld or what, but they basically bond super, super tiny hair-thin wires on the inside of the chip to the leg, which is thicker, and they cast the whole thing in plastic. So the wire bond stays permanently. Like, you'll never lose that, right? And he ran out of area on his chip, mm-hmm. so he had to, like, reduce the size of the pads for the wire bond to be able to get more area for his logic.
Sure.
He had some issue with, like, the rook or something. What's the horse called? Is the bishop or the rook? I think it's called the rook.
The horse is the knight.
Okay, whatever. The horse thing.
The rook is the castle.
Okay.
And the bishop is the thing that goes
knight.
Back.
Okay, I just looked it up. It's a knight. Okay, so the knight, he had problems with the knight.
How did you look that up that quickly?
Dude, I've got an iPad with me.
All right.
The knight does that weird L shape, and he, like, messed up the logic on the L shape.
Oh.
but he was able to fix it in software by like,
okay,
because it had like a, I guess a picture of the board internally, so he would like the it could do the L one direction but not the other, so he like internally messed, I don't know, he did something, but
pretty complicated.
Yeah.
How long ago was this?
Well, I don't know when Big Blue was. I mean, it was in the 90s, right? Because I remember the Pepsi commercials. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the Pepsi commercials?
Sure.
Yeah. So it was in the 90s, I think. We could look it up, but yeah. So that was really crazy, like the amount of work that he had to do. Like, it was very interesting to hear him talk about like the logic and the, there's like some known algorithms for the cost of each unit and stuff like that. And I don't think it did a lot of like predicting. I think it just kind of like looked at the board and went. Or maybe it might have predicted like one move, but it wasn't like crazy.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Okay.
So the book is called What Computers Cannot Do.
Yeah, from
the
50s. It's by Hubert Dreyfus.
All right.
And yeah, I could only get through about half of the book because it was just nonstop bitching about.
Was it dry or was it actually interesting? But
it was
bitching?
Interesting in the sense that it's surprising to know just how advanced computer technology was in the 50s. People don't really realize this, but if you search on YouTube for example, IBM RAMAC, RAMAC, which is a random access
memory core
accounting, it's random access method for accounting and control.
Whoa.
Right?
Right.
And so IBM invented the world's first hard drive back then. And
which was like the size of a washing machine, right?
Way bigger than a washing machine. It's like, it's a washing machine for the drive itself,
mm-hmm.
but then it spans out in sort of like a C shape. And it's this whole, it's like a command center.
Wow.
Where there's a typewriter in the middle where you type in each register for accounting.
Right, for the
register, and so you might
yeah.
think this is ridiculous. Who would buy this? A massive business would buy this, right?
Right, like GM or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly. Who needs to keep track of invoices and everything, right? Otherwise, if a customer calls and says, for example, I don't know, just something simple. How much money do I owe in my account?
Right.
I don't know. Let me hold on while I have someone
mail that
in
to
a
me.
Different department.
Yeah.
Go down, open your file, read through your whole thing, call me back and tell me how much money you owe.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this thing can, you know, randomly read and write data.
Which is a huge deal. Right? Yeah.
So between the time that it was in existence, all those hard drives, there's like 30 or 50 platters. It's crazy.
That's
it's 5 megabytes
yeah.
to 25 megabytes.
Oh, my God.
It might even be 20 megabytes. But anyway, it's a lot of data for the time. I mean, if you think about it, accounting spreadsheets, that's actually kind of a lot of data.
I wonder if it was a vacuum. It must have had a vacuum in
yep.
there, right? It's all the same.
When you watch the video, you'll be shocked by like how complicated the technology is. And it's a finished product. I remember at the time, you had to... it wasn't just a one-time cost. You had to continue to pay IBM to maintain
it,
right?
Yeah.
Because they're rotating.
It's like
right?
a car, right? I mean,
exactly. So you couldn't.
It's like a jet airplane, actually. Like it needs to be serviced every like a couple hours, not a couple hours, but a couple thousand hours, as opposed
yeah.
to a car, which
so
will last forever.
And a certified IBM technician would come in, who that's his job is to make sure the drive, everything's balanced and weighted,
oil the
exactly.
bearings and shit like that. Yeah.
And so these days, you know, a regular hard drive is the same thing. It does need to be maintained, but it can't. It's not possible, right?
Right.
Because it's not cost effective. Who the hell is going to come from Seagate
open,
and drive to your house?
And open your shit, yeah.
And take your hard drive, take it to a clean room, open it up, re-oil everything, close it back up, take it back to you. Not going to happen.
Yeah.
You're going to buy another, you know, $50 hard drive. So that's the reason why your drives will die and nobody will care. So back up your data.
What was the purpose of this book?
The purpose of it?
The purpose of you telling me about the book was what?
I can't remember. You said something that triggered me.
Okay, so there's this book and it exists. Don't read it.
Yeah, basically, don't read it. But my point of mentioning is just to be surprised about how advanced computers are. And the reason why they're so advanced and nobody can really come to an origin of it and explain it very well is because it goes back so far that...
Oh, you mean like the alien theory guys that are like, oh, well, semiconductors
probably.
Are way too advanced. We've had to have aliens to...
Yeah, somebody told me that about cordless phones. I'm like, actually...
Really?
Yeah.
What was their, tell me their theory. Because don't tell me who they are, because I know that I would just want to punch them in the face. But.
Certainly. Well, like, how does it go through walls? I'm like, well, and then I get into...
RF, which is what I'm doing recently.
Right. And so it's, you know, it's invention on top of invention. It's invention inception,
well,
which is...
It is inception, but it's like, the cool thing about technology is that it's very easy to package it. Like, it's not, well, hardware... With hardware, it's like each chip is its own package. In fact, I was talking to some guys in aerospace, mm-hmm. and the guy was like, oh, well, hardware is so much easier to do than software because your hardware, you write it once, or you build the board once, it just works, you never have to mess with it again. But software, you're always messing with it. And I was like, dude, that's so not fair because every chip that you bought has had 100,000 hours of test and R&D, and all you did was put 45 wires on the board and connect it to the other chip that's had 200,000 hours of testing, QA. So you're not, I mean, your connect hardware is impressive. I'm not shitting on hardware guys, but you can't say, oh, it's so much more reliable because I spent, it only took me 4 hours and your software is still crashing. Well, you're putting together very highly packaged things that all have data sheets, they've all been tested, et cetera. The thing about software though is software builds, like you said, hierarchical or stacking or whatever, mm-hmm. or that's, I would use the word stacking. Sure. Like every layer in your software, like there's the BIOS, which literally just communicates with the hard drive. Okay. Microsoft doesn't write the BIOS, right? They write Windows. Okay. And then somebody writes a network driver, which you didn't write.
Well, it's assumptions. The assumption for each layer is that the last layer is was successful.
And, right? and perfect.
Was successful. Therefore, yeah. You know, exactly. Windows isn't checking all the time that POST was successful, right? It just knows if Windows booted, then that's fine.
Well, if Windows exists and is thinking, then the POST was successful. That's correct. But
right. So yeah. There's like all those layers of assumptions.
But the Windows doesn't know about like seeking on the hard drive. It just says, I would like to read this byte at this index. Right. And the seeking is handled by the driver or by the hardware or whatever. But what I'm trying to say is that because it's all software... And assuming you have unlimited, assuming you have a large space, mm-hmm. like let's say, assuming you had 50 gigabytes of storage, which is actually pretty small, mm-hmm. The amount of software that you can virtually stack, it's like literally stacking into the complexity into infinity. So every layer that you add on is ultra complex, adds the complexity of the whole system, but it doesn't cost you anything. As far as the 50 gigs of space that you paid for that library that you bought, it's like nothing. And then you can stack something on top of that and on top of that. So you're abstracting away, basically you're abstracting away from things, but it'll stack into infinity. And that's why software is so complex. But that's like you said, people don't understand how long we've been stacking stuff on other people. It's like standing on the shoulders of giants, right?
Absolutely.
Like
if you go back all the way, it's a really long way back. So
yeah.
And for this reason, when my students ask me about, I can explain a lot of stuff, really complicated, but when it comes to the CPU, I have a really hard time, as you know.
Yeah.
That's the one thing people really want to know. They're like, well, why is this Atom processor so slow?
Right.
And I'm like...
Air quotes. He did air quotes, by the way.
Yes, air quoted. That's sort of hard to say. And I get to thinking about Apple's A4 chip was mm-hmm. the first time that they rolled out their custom silicone. They bought out a chip manufacturing company. I forget.
I don't know. Well, the thing about ARM, by the way, just a quick aside, is that ARM doesn't manufacture chips. They just make chip designs. So ARM will design. Basically, ARM has a, I don't know if it's Verilog. I don't know what ARM sells you, but effectively it's not exactly a mask, but it's basically a mask.
Okay.
They either give you a mask for the silicon, or they give you something that is one-to-one convertible into a mask.
Okay. So it's basically all the geniuses that make that massively complicated
thing, right?
Which is the thing that I can't explain.
Right. And so that, well, it's an array of transistors, basically, and right. other things, which, if I don't know if that's what we want to talk about, we can, because I took that class. Oh, my God, it was awful. I probably got a B in it or something. But, what ARM sells you, there are configuration bits. So you can pick and choose if you want to add those parts mm-hmm. to your chip. So if somebody like Apple or whoever, like Freescale, I'm working with a Freescale ARM at work mm-hmm. right now. So Freescale bought the design from ARM, and then Freescale maybe makes 100 variations. And each variation has so much RAM, it may or may not have specific units or whatever, but all those configurations are passed down from ARM. So okay. there's like two data sheets. There's like the data sheet that Freescale makes and there's the data sheet that ARM makes. And in the ARM data sheet, it'll say, depending on your configuration, mm-hmm. you may or may not have this option.
Jesus.
Yeah, it's complicated. So the A4, you were saying about the A4.
Yeah, I mean, the A4
was
such a huge deal. They bought a company called, I'm going to have to look it up.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's cool. But anyway, so they bought basically their own custom silicon company,
right?
Right, which made a custom version of ARM,
right?
Which is why, I'm not sure if any of you remember this, but the iPhone 4 had the best battery life ever of any of the iPhones. It was the first revision of their chip.
Okay.
And so they obviously spent a huge amount of time debugging it, making sure. It was sort of an unprecedented move. There was never any other company that's made their own chip.
Right.
And their own hardware and the software. It's like, that's way too much customization.
I mean, well, yes and no. I mean, that lets them control the whole stack, though. Which right. is very important.
Which is pretty impressive this late. I mean, you know, you could get an old flip phone, and I'm not sure what type of processor.
I don't know what kind of processor, but it runs Symbian, right?
Yes. That was the Nokia's one.
Their operating OS. System? Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, using... I remember when they switched to the A5 with the 4S, you know, the battery life was just, like, gone. Because it was clear that they just ramped up the cycles to make it faster,
right.
and then... the power saving thing was not there, and it was
right.
it was night and day battery difference.
Well, most chips have a most efficient. Every chip has the most efficient speed to run it at, and almost actually guaranteed that that's not going to be the fastest speed.
Got it.
So, like, if you want to say how many floating point operations can I do for how many milliwatts or how many watts of power or whatever, mm-hmm. there's going to be a speed that'll be the most efficient. So if you're running on battery, if you don't care about speed and you're running on battery, you want to run at that speed. But it's never the fastest.
Gotcha.
So. All
right.
Yeah.
So, next segment?
Sure. I mean, I could give you the rundown on the whole silicon thing. I think that's fucking boring and overplayed, but I mean, you're welcome to...
I mean, it's not overplayed for me, only because I have such a hard time explaining
it. Okay, well, let's table that for later if we feel like it. So what?
Fair enough.
So Sam has my iPad here with a PDF of something, which you were telling me about.
Right. So, a couple of weeks ago, I did a forensic seminar for attorneys. And it was an event in which I explained...
By the way, I bought a ticket and I didn't go, so you owe me $10.
Well, I'm giving you the presentation right now.
Ah, fuck. Right.
This is a high-value
okay.
thing. It was
yeah,
sold,
it's a one-on-one. Okay, it's one-on-one.
On
yeah, yeah. What do you mean it was sold out thanks to me?
All the tickets sold out, and you bought one of the early bird tickets, so...
But if I hadn't bought one, somebody else would have bought one. Did
right.
you make any money?
Yeah, I ended up getting it. I only had 20 tickets total because there's only 20 seats available in the
mm-hmm.
place. So after Eventbrite took their thing, it's like $100-something.
How much was the venue?
90-something. I can't remember. Half of the tickets were double the price of the early bird tickets.
Nice.
So I can't remember.
But how much was the venue, though?
What do you mean? Oh, it's my own office.
Oh, so you
it's
didn't...
included
so it was free.
In my rent for my office.
So the venue was... basically free, so it's pure profit.
Well, if you were to divide my office rent per day, then yeah, there's
well, right, but you're already, but that's a cost you're already paying for, so it doesn't
exactly.
Yeah, okay.
So
he has a PDF here.
There's a famous scientist who basically all people in forensics, and that includes the physical stuff as well as the software stuff for these days. They try and prevent the transfer of data between what you encounter in a crime scene, right? So that's
it's like a one way. It's like wearing gloves.
Correct. And
right.
so for computers, you know, originally when computer forensics were brand new in the you know very late 80s and 90s, they didn't know what to do. They would just take your computer, boot it up, and then
like turn it on, right?
Yeah,
which is the worst
on,
idea. Yeah,
and then look through it and be like, oh, well, what do you know? Somebody wrote a script that deleted everything. That sucks.
Without, yeah.
What are we going to do about that?
Right.
And so. Over time, you know, they figured, well, we can't turn these computers on anymore. We have to develop more sophisticated measures.
Right.
And so Locard's exchange principle is
okay.
something that's cited.
Let's read it.
That explains, it's a theory relating to the transfer of trace evidence between objects, stating that every contact leaves a trace. So the theory dictates that when two objects come in contact with one another, each will take something from the other object or leave something behind. So,
so
we're trying to prevent that.
But there is some famous... scientists from way, way, way older said you can't observe something without affecting it.
Right. Well, that gets into quantum stuff, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, but even if you think about observing a monkey mm-hmm. in the forest, like the best thing that today we could do is we could put a camera in the forest. Like, that would be the best way to observe a monkey without...
Right.
But if it's
you'll
noticed...
You'll never know if the camera is affecting...
Right. But you do know if it notices it. And if the battery explodes and melts into the ground, then the grub that the monkey's going to eat is going to be fucking contaminated with acid, and you've fucking affected that monkey. Like, you're not getting around it, you know? So, yeah.
Gotcha.
So, according to this principle, is the idea that you don't want to significantly
right.
You want to reduce it as much, but basically it's non-significant, right?
And so the point is we keep this in mind. So, for example, if I come into a crime scene, Ben's computer has been accused of something really horrible.
Yeah.
I come into his apartment, and he's got tons of screens on and all this shit running on the screen, and I'm like, oh, my God. So I'm concerned about what processes are actively running. If I pull the plug and take the hard drive out, I may kill the active processes and never know what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to stick in a thumb drive and download all the live data.
All the RAM?
Sure. Dump the RAM.
Dump the RAM, right. And what else can you do besides dumping the RAM?
There's a couple of other things. Like the registry, for example, has a lot of volatile keys.
Oh, well, that would be in the RAM, but...
Maybe.
But it's hard to find. A RAM, exactly. A RAM image is like the brute force way. You want to actually get the fine... tooth comb and pull the stuff you need, which would be registry.
And so there are scripts that will automatically like pull all this live data. Mm. But the point is, by sticking the thumb drive in, I'm affecting...
Right, the driver, it loaded the USB driver.
Exactly. Yep. Loaded the USB driver, and it's put whatever the temporary stuff is, it's actually loading that data into memory also, potentially overriding something else.
Right.
You know, so... Anyway, so that's the point of that. So... there are... So for that reason, we usually use hardware write blockers when you take a drive out. I don't personally use one just because I use a software one that's just as... I've tested it so much that there's no point in me using a hardware write blocker.
Is that something that is admissible in court?
It is because I've tested it, so I can submit...
What I mean to say is that would that be something that would be contestable in court?
Sure, absolutely. So everything is, you should always assume that whatever you do is going to be contested by another person like me. It's going to be like, that's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
So... I set the bar pretty high because I'm contesting myself, and I would be pretty annoying.
Yeah.
So so I actually have videos ready to go that show my processes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Exactly. Do you have to submit those all the time?
I've never had to because for some reason, I guess, the FBI is not as cool as everybody wants you to think.
Yeah.
They don't have – they actually don't pay very well. So
they don't attract,
I'm not sure who they attract exactly, but,
they leak talent.
It's a lot of work they're asking of you for not a lot of money. So, my guess is the only reason why people get hired there is, just to say they work for the FBI. Hmm. I mean, something. They look really cool on TV, but,
yeah.
I don't know.
What was that stupid thing? I'm going to write a script in Visual Basic or whatever from like, wasn't from NCIS or some bullshit like that. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I think we played it on the pod. I think we actually played it on the pod. Merrick had mentioned it or something years ago. Yeah.
I was going to reverse look up an IP using Visual Basic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway, I use a software write blocker and then make a full bitstream image of the entire
So what's this slide say?
This is...
By the way, are we posting the slide online or is that not cool?
I think we could.
What a dick. He's being a dick, everybody.
No, we absolutely could.
What a fucking dick. He was like, I don't know. It's my proprietary baby. I worked on it.
It'll be fine. Whatever. We can post it. So a bitstream image copy is just from beginning to end all the sectors, includes the unallocated space.
Right.
Which gets me into carving, which I'll get to later.
Okay, let's talk about that, yeah.
Later. Because you were kind of interested in the carving.
I was very interested in that. It seems very interesting.
All right. So the evidence format that I use is EO1. The EO1 evidence format is...
What software does that?
Well, it's become a standard. It was originally developed by Guidance Software, which makes Encase one of the biggest...
Forensic
software. I don't use Encase, not for any particular reason. It's just extremely expensive, so I use their competitor, FDK.
The reason particularly because it was expensive?
Mostly.
That seems like you just...
But FDK is also annoying, so I may end up just... going to Encase anyway. They're all extremely expensive. Ben just killed the 40, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Champagne and beers.
Quite.
No, yeah, it says it says on the bottle, right?
I do.
Okay.
I'll tell you a funny story about that sometime.
All right.
but anyway, so the EO1 evidence format has a lot of benefits, and so I think I covered some of those.
He's scrolling viciously, wildly.
But I'll just explain it. So some of the benefits is that it's self-verifiable. So
it's hash?
Yeah, so when you are recording the original evidence, it not only does it do a full MD5 hash of everything,
right.
But it also does CRC blocks.
Right, that's what I've always said, is you want to have hashes that overlap.
Oh, right.
Because it's super impossible. If you think
it is beyond impossible.
If the chances of breaking a single... Well, first off, MD5 is like the worst thing. Like, I would be really surprised. Like, if you want to talk about the forensics guys being super hardcore, all the crypto guys are like 20, 1,000 times more hardcore.
Big time.
And the crypto guys have moved away from MD5 like 10 years ago. Like, it was
a long time ago.
It was provable. I was like a Word document. They had been MD5 signing a Word document, and these guys added a message to the end of it and signed it again correctly or whatever.
And they were able to make it match. Right?
Yeah. So that's a bad format. However, if you have overlapping, it becomes much stronger because you have to... I don't know what the chances of an MD5 collision are.
I will show you right now.
Okay.
Ready for this? Math guy?
All right.
There it is. Didn't see that coming, did you?
This is not very much, though. The odds of any two files... Shut up. The odds of any two files having to say MD5 are 1 in 2,128. Or 1...
That's the full readout.
You didn't... You didn't write that correctly.
Sorry, dude. I'm not a math guy.
You must mean 1 in 2 to the 1,228. Must be what you mean. Yeah, it is a big, it is big. But that's, I mean, if you're
better off winning the lottery.
I don't know how to spell this number. I'm pretty sure it's 1 or either 10 to the power or 2 to the power of 2,128, which is a big number. But that's like, it pales in comparison to SHA-1 or SHA-2. Like, those are like orders of magnitude better. So,
right. So usually when I document the final hash of evidence,
Did you find that number?
It was in one of the books that I read.
So the reason I don't buy that is because I don't know how long an MD5 is. The output probably it's 2,128 bytes. Yeah, that's exact. How many characters is that?
Let's count the characters.
2,128. I'm just gonna figure it out for you.
Okay. We can possibly edit this out.
No, it's fine. This is like fucking live podcast. By the way, do you know iOS does not have a built-in calculator for the iPad?
This doesn't make any sense. Why the hell not?
Because they didn't want to scale it up or something?
So you have a skeuomorphic...
what do you mean skeuomorphic?
With the, you know, it doesn't have...
Yeah. That fucking stupid word. Okay, so I predict that a hash is 226 characters. That's not right.
Yeah, no way.
Dude, your fucking math drives me nuts, so I don't know. Yeah, the answer is I don't know. Anyways, it looks like about 30 or 40 characters.
Okay. The guy who wrote the book worked with the developers of...
But this is the thing. Of MD5? That's bad. You don't want to... That's like fucking conflict of interest, for the record. So I'm guessing that this fucking epic huge number is just the number of possible MD5 outputs...
Right.
But that's not actually the number... That's not equal to saying, well, you're going to... If you said, okay, well, obviously the answer is one of these big number. Mm-hmm. Right? But that's assuming that your dice... That you have a dice that has that many sides, and every time you roll it, it randomly lands on a side.
Sure.
But I think the problem with MD5 is the dice has weighted. So that collections areas of the hashes are much more likely to land on than others.
Sure.
So that's the reason everybody went away from MD5, because it's big enough. The output is big enough to be like secure, but the outputs are grouped.
Sure.
So this number is not accurate. That's all I'm saying. So you don't want to trust the guy that made it because he doesn't. He's gonna be supporting it.
But there has never been a combination of MD5 plus all these CRCs throughout the data blocks.
That's awesome.
That, you know, has ever been proven. So, obviously, I mean, that would be ridiculous. How the hell would that ever line up, right?
Right. It's never going to line up.
So, CRC plus MD5 is pretty freaking secure.
That's awesome.
So, as you can see, this is a problem with the parser.
Oh, the PDF looks...
We're looking at a PowerPoint on...
A Safari.
Through Safari on an iPad.
Right.
So...
Yeah.
I don't think that the parser is working quite as well as it could be, but it's not bad.
No, it's working out.
I'll skip this because this is just...
Okay, sure.
You know. So the cool thing about an EO1 file is that you can... I do this even for stuff that's not forensic related, just when I have data recovery.
Capture them and mount. We can mount TBAs too. TIBs. TIBs.
One of those. Yep. So mounting is a big deal, because I'll take an evidence file and they're like, well, did this computer have viruses? I don't know. Let's find out.
Mount it. Scan it with
the virus scanner. And then whatever the output is, I just document all the viruses. Super easy.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to have to manually try and like do this crazy thing using forensic software.
But well, you'd have to like, just mount it. No, you'd have to like flash it to a real drive and then plug it in.
Right.
That would be the only other option. Oh, my God.
It's just forget it. So mount it real quick. A lot of other times I'll use other forensic software to make a full index of the drive while it's mounted and then just execute searches on it. So if we're just looking for PDFs. Stuff. Right. So we'll just do a search for like whatever.
And you just put it in a text file?
Sure. Well, the software I'm talking about is called ISIS. ISYS.
Oh, yeah. ISIS. And, or ISIL. It's called ISIL or ISIS?
This is way before that. But, you know. We're trying not to get political in this podcast. Difficult sometimes. But
yeah, every time we say ISIS, I want to say ISIL, just so we're... So tell me about ISIS.
Fair enough. This software is excellent. It's like the fastest searching software ever. It's way better than Windows Search, way better than other ones you may have used.
Have you heard of everything.exe?
No.
Dude, everything is fucking fast. I can find it for you. Joel, the guy I'm working with right now, showed it to me.
Can we put a link in the podcast?
Sure. It's everything.exe. I will. All right. Yeah, it's awesome.
Excellent. Okay. So, yeah, if that turns out to be better than ISIS, which is commercial software, by the way.
ISIL.
if it turns out to be better than that, then that would be awesome.
Okay.
Okay. So, so the interesting thing about EO1s, you can actually reprocess them. So if I'm on the fly and I don't have a lot of time and I want to process your 80 gigabyte hard drive here,
right.
I can do it uncompressed, just take a whole EO1 of it, but then later on redo it with like 9 compression. So it's actually compressed, but still verifiable with
the MD5. It's a 1-to-1 compression. It's not lost. It's lossless compression.
Exactly.
Right. Like a zip file is lossless. So yeah.
Right. So it's kind of cool that you can just in the same thing, just recompress it later, then get rid of the bigger one.
Right.
Right.
Awesome.
I mean, I have way too many EO1s anyway.
Floating around, yeah.
Right. So if I do like a DD or whatever, there's nothing wrong with that, but now I have to have a report that follows that around that contains an MD5, and it doesn't have those CRC blocks.
Right. So they made a file format that has it all.
All in one.
That's exactly. Cool.
And there's also, if you look at here, this header here, you can put, I can put my name, case notes, all this cool stuff.
So you can put, you have like, it's like a ID3 tag or whatever.
Exactly. Okay. And then that also has a CRC.
And so that's optionally long, I guess, I'm assuming?
Yeah.
Arbitrarily long?
Sure, actually.
Try pasting all of Wikipedia in there and see what happens.
Okay. Wikipedia. That's the standard. I talked about virtual machines because you can convert EO1s into bootable VMDKs or VDIs.
Oh, that's awesome. That's perfect.
Then you boot up the computer and you put that in front of a jury and it's like, dude.
There's the porn right there.
Exactly.
Well, the child porn.
And so I show this screenshot which just shows Vista, OS X, and Fedora Box, like all in one.
All
like
from real cases. From real cases. That's awesome.
So, it's pretty awesome. Then you can just execute searches and you can see the stuff that you normally have to do in forensics is look through like jump lists or recently MRUs.
Right, most recently used
stuff.
Yeah.
It's a pain in the ass to look through the registry for that when you could just like click it on the actual machine and be like
print screen.
Be like, dude, this guy, yeah.
Yeah.
And end up with like screenshots of it.
Cool.
Getting into smartphones, I tried to explain the difference between logical and physical acquisitions.
Okay.
So if I take this iPad here running version 7, there's no way I can do a physical acquisition unless I jailbreak it.
Okay.
Because I don't have access to the underlying
raw data. You don't have access to the file system, yeah.
Exactly. I only have access to whatever Apple lets me have access to.
Right.
So.
And then jailbreaking would be like tainting your evidence, right?
A little bit, right? Because you have to fuck with it. But given how all the free space that I'm going to get, and I'm going to get a whole acquisition of it, usually it's worth it. So again, low cards exchange principle, and I have to document it too. I have to explain I jailbroke it using which version of which thing, so that later on, if it becomes an issue, you know, someone could challenge it and say, "Well,
you jailbroke it, those child porn pictures appeared on the drive." You're like, "Well, that's fucking bullshit."
Right, but you have to prove it now, right? The
photo stream is modified by your jailbreak. Right.
Exactly. So, if you and I are texting each other. All that data gets added to the sms.db file.
Right. And that's what's it called? SQLite?
SQLite. Is it still 3? Is there anything past SQLite
3? I'm not sure. It's okay. SQLite.
As I understand it, everything is in SQLite 3 format.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the apps, curiously, pretty much look the same. Like, you, if you have an SQLite 3 browser, you look at one app, or, you know, look at the PayPal app, look at...
JoinMe.
Yeah. It's all... You can browse that data using an SQLite browser, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's why the limitations of all apps are pretty clear, because everything is limited to database, and then everything else you have, camera, Wi-Fi, everything's all piping data in and out of a database.
Sure.
Right.
I mean, that's... To be fair, that's every app on the entire internet ever, so every website and every app you've ever used.
Right. Databases.
So, databases, but saying that that's limiting is, I mean, that's not exactly correct.
It's not limiting. Okay, it's freeing and limiting at the same time.
I mean, it does, it makes the data not uniform, it is kind of uniform. It makes accessing it all uniform, but it doesn't limit you. I mean, iOS can run arbitrary code. Sure. So within limits of processing power, you can run any code that you can run on your desktop, you could run on iOS if somebody wrote it and they had enough processing power. I know those are like two big ifs, but I mean, it can run anything. I mean, you don't have to store your data in the SQLite format. Almost everybody does, because Apple lets you do that really easily, but you could store it however you wanted to. So, you keep that in mind, I guess.
Gotcha. I really didn't know that. I thought either you had to put it in that format.
Well, you could put it in that format, but what if there was only one entry, which was a giant binary blob that had some other format in it, right?
All right, fair enough. But it can't escape the sandbox.
Not unless it's jailbroken, no. So that is a huge limitation, is the sandbox. Yeah.
And so, which gets me back to what I wanted to do with one of your pay-for apps,
mm-hmm.
was make a special version for jailbroken ones so that people downloaded it illegally... you would have consequences because you'd be running it on a jailbroken phone and it would mess with your phone in some way.
Yeah.
Right? So you would be punished, therefore, by downloading that illegal version.
Yeah, yeah.
But you never got around to doing that.
Well, I never got around to making an app that was cool enough that people wanted and that it was paid for, and then that we could make a fake pay-for version to put in. So it's a lot of, like...
There's a lot of ifs and...
A lot of requirements to get that working.
Right.
Yeah. So, locked iPhone...
So, when you have a locked iPhone, for those of you who don't know this, you don't have to have just a 4-character password.
You can have
a really long, real password on your iPhone.
Right.
And so that really long password is actually extremely secure because it's tied down with hardware encryption. So,
I'm about to fucking tell you you're fucking wrong, but finish your slide and I'll tell you you're wrong.
Fair enough. So if I have a really long password, I don't know, just 8 characters long, it's going to take me forever to break your password.
Right.
And I can't circumvent it easily. All my only options are to do standard dictionary attacks, mutations.
Right.
And, of course, just brute force.
Right.
Which is going to take you centuries.
Right.
I'm not sure about the salting and all that, so... Based on the charts I've seen...
If it's salted, that means you can't rainbow table it. But I don't know who's making rainbow tables for iOS passwords.
As far as I know, nobody.
Nobody.
Right. But tell me why I'm wrong about hardware encryption.
So, it turns out, I don't have the article, I might be able to find it.
Okay.
It turns out that when you turn your iPhone, okay, you turn your iPhone off,
okay,
you turn it on,
mm-hmm.
everything's encrypted.
Right.
The first time you put your password in,
mm-hmm.
the volume is mounted and never unmounted.
Right. I do know that. Because there's like a big deal about that in forensics.
So, basically, the password, if the phone is on...
Mm-hmm.
You've got it. You don't have to fucking do it. I don't know the process. I don't know what you have to do to get that data. You might act... In fact, I don't even know if you get the password, but you might only get what was in that, what was in the volume. So what's encrypted with this encryption here?
Okay.
Is it the whole phone? Is it...
Well, hang on. This thing real quick, the lockdown certificates. So if I plug my phone into your computer right now and hit... The first thing it says is, do you want to trust this computer?
Trust the computer.
Do you trust Ben's computer?
No.
Absolutely not. So if I click no... The phone won't do anything, but if I unplug and plug it back in, my phone will once again ask me, do you trust Ben's computer?
Right.
Trust, don't trust. So eventually I'll be like, okay, whatever, like trust.
Right.
Or Ben will do it when I go to the bathroom. He'll plug it in real quick,
right.
Trust, and then unplug it and leave my phone on the table again.
Right.
And I'll never know that he let it trust it. What happened, though, when he pushed the trust button is that on his phone is now a lockdown certificate.
Okay.
It's this little file that basically... lets this iPhone know forever that iTunes is now trusted with it.
So it'll let you unlock the phone?
No, but what it'll let me do is create a backup file of it. So I can hit backup on iTunes,
and over
it
won't the Wi-Fi. Prompt,
it won't, or over Wi-Fi, but we have to check the box with it plugged in. And it will automatically initiate a backup without any other prompting on the iPhone.
Which is awesome. But that's not a realistic case for forensics, though.
Sure, that's just a case for fucking with your
buddy. Right.
Right? I serve a search warrant.
You still have to unlock it, though,
right? I get your phone. Well, right. It has to be... I have to accept it at least one time.
But you can't accept it when the phone's locked.
Correct. So. But if I serve a search warrant, get your computer... copy the lockdown file to my forensic machine, plug in your phone.
You're done.
I get a backup file of the most recent data on your phone.
Even if the phone's been restarted?
Correct. Because the lockdown file lets it, assumes it trusts the computer implicitly.
Okay.
Right?
That's really cool.
So, I show a slide here which shows this because people don't understand that like an iPhone is Linux. And so
it's
I show BSD, them, like, this is the same shit that you see, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I tried to explain a little bit about how FileSlack works.
Right.
So if I have two clusters, right?
Right.
And let's say I had a picture that took up exactly two clusters. In this case, that's 8 sectors worth of data.
Okay.
So I then delete the picture, and then I put a second picture on it that only takes up, smaller. So 5.5 sectors.
Okay.
That remaining data between sector 6 and 8 can be carved out. I can pull that data out and then show it as a picture, and I would get that little bit of a picture left over.
Okay.
Right? Because the data is still hanging out because it was reserved.
Right.
Right? The data cannot... It isn't dynamic. You have to reserve clusters for data.
Well, it's literally like if you wrote an essay on a piece of paper with a pencil,
mm-hmm.
and then you wanted to change some sentences around.
Right.
At some point, if your sentence needs to be longer, you're fucked. So you either have to...
You're not going to just somehow be able to resize that.
Resize your entire... You have to go through and do that manually, which they don't do. Also, the reason that that data isn't zeroed out mm-hmm. is because it... Every time that you write to your flash file system, mm-hmm. you wear it out.
Right. That's also true.
Mm-hmm. So it would be very... It would put a lot of wear and tear on your... iPhone memory, basically without needed for no reason.
Right. It's unnecessary.
Unnecessary is a word, yeah.
Oh, or high watermelon. That is absolutely fantastic.
All right. So tell me about carved Slack space and file system, whatever.
Okay. So that's the Slack space is the gap between sector 6 and 8. That's the leftover data. And that's going to be there basically forever until...
Unless you delete the surrounding files, or... Does iOS have defragment?
To the best of my knowledge, no. Because...
Well, you know, it depends. I wonder what file system they're using. Because, like, EXT3 supposedly doesn't need to be defragmented. Like, it does it on its own. But they might... they might be using EXT2. Like, I don't know what file system they're
whatever
using.
Whatever it is, there's no way that it would do any defragmenting. Because if you think about it... That would consume battery life. It's spending time clearing out.
Right, but it could do that. It could defragment when it was plugged in.
And it's an SSD. Why would it need to defragment?
Okay. All right. I mean,
my guess is that it
for the record, it probably doesn't. For the record, SSDs, you should only defragment your SSD like once a year. Like you get a very 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 marginal benefit from defragmenting your SSD.
I didn't know that you got any at all.
Well, there is a very, very tiny delay. If the file's in multiple places, you do add seek time. I know the seek time is like fucking nanoseconds.
Right.
But if you're on Windows, which has very poor file fragmentation,
mm-hmm.
and the file's fragmented in like a million places,
mm-hmm.
it does sort of add up. But you don't want to do it all the time because it wastes write cycles.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. So, I have a screenshot here,
which says, coffee at 2:30, question mark.
That's not the point.
The other guy says, sure. Meeting moved to 2:30. How about 2 instead, question mark, smiley face. Okay, for sure, spelled F-E-R-S-U-R-E. And then after 2:32 p.m., bro, exclamation point. So, who did you do this with?
This was actually from a real case of mine. And so, I took this.
For sure, F-E-R-S-U-R-E.
Yes, I have a lot of different types of cases. This was a rape case.
So who said for sure? The chick or the rapey or the rapist?
Actually, that would be the girl. who said bro. That's curious. I'm surprised now that you mentioned that. It was just the most innocuous part because it doesn't explain what the case is about.
It doesn't say, let me it's penetrate like, you later or exactly. You're going to get... Yeah.
Okay. And since I was, you know, this is whatever, presentation.
It's a presentation for the public.
Yeah. Right. And so on top, there's a timestamp. So it says Tuesday, February 4th, 12:09 p.m.
Okay.
And then arbitrarily after okay for sure is Tuesday, February 4th, 2:32 p.m.
Right.
Doesn't show a year. It doesn't tell me what time zone. If I got these screenshots and they were from New York, it wouldn't tell me, by the way, this is, you know, Eastern Standard Time, right. Or Eastern Daylight Time.
Right.
What fucking time zone is this? Doesn't tell me. So in a lot of cases, I'll get screenshots from some sort of government agency. And I'll tell them, this is not going to work. Like, don't even bother presenting these. I'll challenge the fuck out of these. These are ridiculous. That doesn't mean anything to me.
Right.
And I can take this into Photoshop, make that whatever fucking time I want. I don't want to hear about it.
Right.
And so that will get that thrown out immediately. So don't even bother with that. Mm-hmm. But it takes me into a longer thing. So I have a screenshot here using software that I use, Oxygen Forensic Suite.
Okay.
And here's all the details. So same exact text, right?
It looks like a web page. It looks like PHPBB from 1993. I'm just telling you.
It's just data, right?
But I understand, but I'm saying that. So it has deleted, read status, direction.
Here it is. Coffee at 2:30, right? Direction, okay. Outgoing, read status. Was it read? Yes or no?
Device time, UTC time. Oh, my God.
Was it deleted?
No.
Right? And it gives me UTC time and the device time.
Perfect.
Device time is key because what...
Time zone. Know,
where did I seize this device from? And then I can compare it with UTC and determine, okay, this thing was in the East Coast at that time, right? And it's per message.
Every message has all that. So if you were traveling...
Right. I would know that.
You would know that.
Which is pretty key. And you have to know that. You can't just be guessing. Like,
right. They could be... I mean... Rapists are always upwardly mobile people that are flying. They're jet setting around all the time.
Is that right?
No, that's just my joke.
So, taking a break from that real quick, the backup files, I've encountered a lot of cases recently, like civil cases that are not really, the goal of them is not to be trying to reconstruct people's phones, but while going through evidence, I'll discover that they have iPhone backups. And the iPhone backups contain
everything.
All of the following.
Okay, let's hear it.
Contacts, call and FaceTime history, messages including SMS and iMessage, notes, voice memos, internet history, photos and videos, app data. And that's all apps that could have ever been installed.
Right.
Photo stream data, MMS data, like every single picture ever that was ever sent.
Right.
That's in a big fucking folder. Voicemail, system preferences, the user-generated dictionary, which I'll cover in a second, Bluetooth and Wi-Fi networks that have all been connected to, the SMS.db file, which can include the deleted text.
So the Wi-Fi networks are the MAC address, the SSID and MAC address. Is it to give you the MAC address, do you know?
I don't think I ever... It's never come up in a case of mine.
Because if you got to Starbucks Wi-Fi, that would tell you you went to a Starbucks. But if it gave you the MAC address, and I don't know if Starbucks has unique MAC addresses, but I assume that they do... Then you would be able to find if you you would have to drive around for a while, but you could prove that they were at this Starbucks.
Right. Usually, we just subpoena it.
Subpoena Starbucks.
Yeah, I mean, just whichever one, and then they would dump their whole router logs and like everything. And then,
oh man,
I'm accustomed to having way too much information.
You have a search problem.
Yeah, and so
consolidated.db. What's that again?
Oh, we'll get to that next.
Oh, that's the location
somewhere
thing.
Somewhere along here. Yeah.
Oh man, have you pulled that successfully?
Yeah, that's actually awesome. A screenshot from my own
that's
testing
awesome.
With it because I wanted to make sure I know what I'm talking about for
yeah.
my presentation. So I'll encounter these backup files and I'll ask my clients, "Did you want to reconstruct the entire phone? Did you want every single text message from the phone through this date?" And they're like,
yeah.
"Oh my God, yes."
Okay.
I'm like, well, they shouldn't have left that iTunes backup file. I mean, most people don't know that this file, you know, exists. I mean, what the hell?
It's like a hash. It's literally an SHA-1 hash.
Is that what that is?
Yeah, dude.
It's a hash of your phone.
Look, there's no letters. There's no letters beyond F. See, F is the biggest letter.
I haven't noticed that, but what is it a hash of? Is it of your...
It's probably it might be a hash of the whole thing. It might just be a unique hash. It could just be a unique hash.
Because this folder will stay the same every time you back up your file. So
it could be a hash of
your GUID.
It could be a hash of a billion things.
Right.
Like, it's just a identifiable hash.
Okay.
Which doesn't change, I guess.
So in Windows, it's in app data, roaming, Apple computer, mobile sync, backup. So
right.
It's kind of a buried location, and as I understand it, there's no easy way to change that. It's like pretty much going to be there.
iTunes is pretty much hardwired. Yeah, is this another is this screenshot cutting off the text here? Is that another artifact?
No, this is my screenshot. I mean, I just
wait. Look, you see, it's cutting off the word there.
Yeah, my presentation obviously was not like that.
So that's an artifact of us using iPad. Okay.
All right. So, you know, if you're going to be, you want to make sure you know where your backup files are. Don't go to your girlfriend's house, plug in your phone, and then forget.
Because your girlfriend's going to do all this stuff.
Your girlfriend is going to totally forensically examine your backup file.
Right.
And she's going to figure out
fucking find you're cheating on her and fucking dump you. Okay.
So I just included a screenshot of raw app data to show that, like, basically what kind of stuff it contains, like recent transaction history. I can put that through my SQLite thing. Figure out what's there.
Wait, what is this?
This is just a screenshot of the PayPal app.
Oh, this is the data contained within that app. So you know what's funny about the dot apps is they're just zips, right? We talked about this, I think.
They are?
Yeah, I think so.
I think you did mention that.
Yeah.
Anyway. Either way, they're so easy to open that, like, I never
really... With what?
This, for this piece of thing, I'm using, what is it called? iBackup Viewer. Using the professional version. It's, all it is a parser for backup files.
Right.
And there's a ton of them, but iBackup Viewer I find to be pretty all-inclusive. It's pretty good. And I do not own any stock in the company, so...
What app was this? PayPal?
Yep, just the PayPal app.
And they use com.yourcompany.pc? Wow.
Yeah, that's common for a lot. I mean, you program.
Well, we did com.joinme.joinme.
So you modified it.
Yeah.
But they figure nobody's going to look through this, so...
But it matters for some... Somewhere it matters, but... Yeah,
I've never noticed it. I've only seen it in here for looking through backup files.
I don't know. That's funny.
A lot of programs, most of them are like this. Your company thing.
Yeah, that's the default in Xcode.
I think...
Usually what you do is you com.companyname.app. So right. JoinMe only had one app, so we called com.joinme.joinme. But if we had another app called JoinMe Messenger, don't set that down so loud. If we had com.joinme.messenger, it'd be com.joinme.messenger or com.joinme.messenger. Whatever.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess it is a little surprising given PayPal and how many millions and millions of dollars they have.
But if you're right, though, I think you're right that it's never exposed publicly.
Right.
Oh, you know what it's used for? It's... Oh, no, never mind. I was going to say it's used for custom URLs. You know how you can launch, like in Glimpse, you can touch a link and it goes to the browser and then the browser says open an app.
Right.
The open an app is a link.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of http://, it's glimpse://
Right.
But that's actually different than the com thing. But that's in the same settings page of Xcode. That's why I got this confused. But, yeah.
By the way, now that I'm holding this iPad Air for so long, it doesn't feel so light anymore.
Dude, you're a fucking pussy. No, I'm just kidding. Apparently, as human beings, we have weak muscles. So that holding a tablet up to read to your face, your arms get tired super fast. If you were a chimp...
It's pretty pathetic.
If you were a chimp with 10x the strength of a man, you wouldn't have that problem.
Gotcha. That was a long way of saying I'm a sissy.
I said pussy. I just said pussy outright. I didn't have to say sissy. just so we're clear.
Consolidated.db. So here's what I did. I took my own phone, which, you know, is running an outdated operating system, 6.1.2.
Which Consolidated.db doesn't apply to the newer ones, right?
Well, they were supposed to have gotten rid of it after iPhone 4, because...
It was an iOS thing, though. It's not tied to the iPhone. It's tied to the operating system, so...
It was a big old thing. If you search the web about it, Apple apologized. They said, look, we're not tracking your location.
We're just tracking it for GPS
basically, enhancing. They say, yeah, so when you click Maps, right, it knows where you are pretty quickly. The reason why is because it's been keeping track of what cell phone tower you were most recently connected to. And it stores that data, so that way when you hit the map, it doesn't have to figure out, okay, where are you?
The other thing is GPS is super shitty indoors.
Right. And so if it can use Wi-Fi triangulation, if it can know your location ahead of time, when you hit the app, it'll know where you are quicker and sooner and
faster. They're not even using Wi-Fi triangulation. You know what they're using? They're saying, well, for GPS takes forever to lock, and if you're indoors, it takes even longer, and sometimes it never locks if you're indoors.
Sure.
But basically what they're saying is that we got a lock at some point in the past, and you were on this Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're assuming that the Wi-Fi has a very low range. So they assume that the previous lock
is around this.
Around here.
Right.
And so if you're on that Wi-Fi, then you're around there.
Sure.
So what that means is that if you move from the East Coast to the West Coast and you bring your home Wi-Fi router, your GPS will snap you to the East Coast even though you're not there anymore.
Ha, makes sense. But if you include that along with cell phone data, you know,
consolidated.db is Apple's, they're sort of crowdsourcing GPS, indoor GPS locations, exactly, or Wi-Fi, which is smart. Right. I mean, yeah, it works great.
They have hundreds and hundreds of thousands
millions and millions and millions of records. Exactly. Billions of records, probably.
And so, but in here, inside of this file is longitude, latitude, and timestamp. I know exactly what time you were at this longitude and latitude.
Awesome.
And so there I am. I copied and pasted that into Google Maps. Bam, that's where I was at that time.
That's awesome.
And I'm not sure what time that is, because that's in Unix time, which is a number of seconds
since 1970. January 1st.
And that, for people who are not technical like you guys, that shocks the fuck out of people. Like, computers can really quickly identify what time it is based off of that big number.
That big number, yeah.
And that number is surprisingly not that long, usually. Well,
it's always less than 4 billion.
Is that right?
When we 4 billion, is it going to happen in 2032?
Okay.
And 4,600,000,000 something is the largest 32-bit integer you can store.
Ah, so we have
so we Y2K actually problem. We actually have a real Y2K coming in 2032.
Okay, so we're going to need like a 64-bit version of that coming out pretty soon.
Well, the cool thing is that if you just represent it in decimal, you don't know how many bits are there. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you need to quote-unquote have a 64-bit version or whatever. Like, if you're storing it in 64 bits, you're already ahead of the game. It's not like the number changes, you know, changes or whatever. So, yeah.
Gotcha.
Windows event log.
Yeah. Oh, so I covered Windows event logs because people are like, did the cops turn on the computer at some point after the search seizure? I'm like, check the event logs. I don't know. Right. If you turn on, it's pretty hard to turn on a computer and not have it write something in the, you know,
right,
to the Windows event
logs. Well, it always logs startup, right?
Yeah, so log, and it actually will tell you the operating system started at time.
Right.
And it will give you this whole timestamp. But look at this. Look at the time on here. 17:43:01. But then look up here. 10:43, you know, 02, 02. Whatever,
01. Okay, yeah.
But it's 01.6, whatever, it's rounded up. Which, the reason why I included this was not just for the event logs, but that is where I will check to see whether or not somebody turned the computer on or not after the search warrant was issued. But it's to say you should never, ever assume that a time zone is a time zone, which is why those screenshots won't work for
me earlier. An iOS screenshot won't tell you what time zone you're in.
Exactly. So, here are the questions. If I'm shown a timestamp of anything, is it in local time or is it in UTC?
Right.
Is it daylight savings time? Like, what are we talking about here?
Are you in Arizona where they don't have daylight savings time?
Exactly.
Fuck those Arizona.
So, what was the time set in the BIOS or the system clock, right? So, with an iPhone, by default, it's set to sync with the cell phone tower to give you the current time.
Right.
But I can just uncheck that and set whatever the fuck time I want, send you a text, take a screenshot.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, there's nothing preventing you from taking a picture and locking that timestamp into the metadata and then setting the time back again afterwards, right? So what was the time of the device when you seized it, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and how sophisticated is the person who,
right,
you know, was using the device? So, and then what was used to convert it? So if you have, like, Unix time, right, like, did you use an online program or did you do it manually? You know,
right,
like,
right.
What did you use to convert it? So when you look through time zones, it's actually surprising. Most of the time is spent in daylight savings time. Right? This is standard time.
He has a
chart, which you guys will see on the spread, on the PowerPoint.
Right.
So this is a standard California daylight savings time.
I would say chart. Like 75 to 80% of the time is spent in daylight savings time.
Right. But like,
so UTC 8, or UTC 7 is daylight savings time, and UTC 8 is...
Yeah, minus 8, negative 8.
Minus 8?
Yeah, because we're behind. UTC is the same thing as...
Greenwich Mean.
Exactly. And so... It's the same thing as London.
Isn't it the same thing as UTC minus leap seconds or something? Or?
Right. You said, remember we looked it up,
yeah.
The difference was like leap years. Mm-hmm. It was some ridiculous like...
A leap second every year.
It was so absurd that
yeah.
I was like, oh, okay. Because in the book that I read, the reason why we did that epic podcast was, it said it's basically the same. And I'm like, what do you mean basically the same?
Oh, the podcast we never released?
They we did end edit? Up releasing it.
Did we?
You did, yeah. It's called Break It Down For Me.
Oh, I don't remember releasing that. No.
Dude, you did.
Time fucking slips away, dude. I'm getting old.
Okay. How old are you?
I'm 28. How old are you?
30.
Okay, so yeah,
it's happening. I'm 31 tomorrow.
Oh, so happy birthday, motherfucker.
So this is the final.
Do I have to buy you something? Wait, whatever.
No.
Wait, is it really your mom's birthday today?
Mm-hmm.
So you're, wow, that's a fucking,
yeah.
She must have felt like a lucky girl 31 years ago.
I suppose. But I was surprised to see
Hey, I was born on Mother's Day, so my mom had a little gift.
That's pretty adorable.
Yeah. But, you know, Mother's Day rolls. It fucking switches around.
Does it? Because I'm going to get into that, into this. I'm going to tie that in, so keep
it's
going.
It's tied to the last Sunday of May, or no, the second Sunday of May, or some bullshit like that.
Interesting. Sunday's a big deal, because...
Okay.
Daylight Savings Time is tied to the Sundays. Here's how it works. Daylight Savings Time is not the same every single year. So in 2010, it looks like it turned into Daylight Savings Time on March 14th.
Right.
2011, it was March 13th. 2012, it was March 11th. It's always a Sunday.
So it changes on the Sunday, which is bullshit, because you're changing Daylight Savings Time because of the rotation, because the Earth is not rotating around the sun at the right axis. It's off axis. But you just picked Sunday, which is totally a human creation.
Yep, has nothing to do with anything in real life.
All right, okay. I'm with you.
But, you know, it's close enough. I mean, what is going to change between March 14th or March 9th, right? But the point is, if I have a case in which these timestamps really matter, and I'm not paying attention to these differences in timestamps, you know, you're gonna fuck your case over. So you got to pay attention to all this. It's like a really big deal. It happens in almost every single case. It's really hard to tell what, you know, if I take a camera and it shows me exit data, it'll just show me a time. How do I know
exit
what time?
It isn't in UTC?
It depends on the camera. Sometimes it'll store it in local time. Sometimes it'll be UTC.
So you have to, like, have...
You have to actually figure out...
Sometimes there's
expert.
A setting, right? Sometimes there's a setting, even, exactly. Right? So you have to really find the device.
You need to, like... Whoever you work with needs to know what the hell they're doing. They can't just be like, oh, it's probably UTC. Like, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
You know, it's a science. Science, for Christ's sakes.
Can you... Okay, wait. So can you... If you didn't have the device, could you recover the time? Would it be... legally defensible to say, if somebody said, hey, what time is it? And you say, oh, it's 8 p.m. and the timestamp says 8 p.m., then you know something? Or the time it says, I mean, is that defensible?
It's
to, like, anchor?
It's helpful unless you can prove it wrong somehow. You can always cast, you can cast out on anything, right?
Are you a male? Right. Are you gay?
How
I
do
think
you know?
So. I think you're super gay.
No, you look pretty gay.
You look pretty gay.
How do you know you're not gay?
Okay, all right.
So it has to do with, you know, how much preponderance of the evidence. That's what we're talking about here.
Preponderance? What does that mean?
A lot of. Would you like me to look up the word?
No, let's...
read this, I'll look up that word.
Okay, well, I'm going to look it up faster than you.
Can't look it up because my phone is...
Look, check it out. All you're going to do is just do this.
For the record, Ben is in an app that I'm not sure how you open that quickly.
Oh, that's spelled incorrectly. It auto-corrected to a word that doesn't exist?
No,
right?
It's preponderance. P-R-E.
It didn't have...
You type way too fast for this operating system.
Look, it doesn't have a definition.
Really?
First off, iOS has a built-in...
Yeah,
okay.
See, it is spelled correctly.
The quality or fact of being greater in number, quantity, or importance. Bad definition, but...
Right, but that's what that means. And a ridiculous amount of evidence.
All right. What were we talking about again? I don't know if you guys can hear that, but my roommate was home, and he's drilling something into the wall. So we bought a magnetic strip where you can hang your knives. And I didn't tell him. I didn't text him, like, hey, the magnetic strip is here. I just stuck it to the refrigerator. I didn't have to open it. I just stuck the strip to the refrigerator, and then... Yeah.
Pretty convenient.
Yeah.
Ben has switched beers, for the record.
So, we need the iPad for your... I was like, we were looking at something. Okay. I wish I could show you my... I want to show you the password lock on this iPad. I chose... So, this iPad, I'm not using the number key. I'm using the keyboard unlock. Mm-hmm. And I chose a password that I think is hard to visualize.
Okay.
It's hard to... If you watch me type it in, it would be hard for you to remember it.
I could see that.
Well, but, I mean, if you... Like, every time I see somebody use the number unlock, in my head I'm always like, Do I know what that is? Like, did I just know that? Did I just pick that up from a single entry? Mm. And most of the time the answer is yes.
Most of the time, yeah.
So I thought about it. I was like, is there a password that would be hard to... Anyways, we can look at that later. So here's your stupid PDF. We're talking about time zones on Sundays.
Right. So it always lands on Sunday. This was the... Time zones are ridiculous, and it shows this to explain that. NTFS stores everything in UTC.
Okay.
But FAT stores everything in local time.
In local time, of course.
Right? So if I have a flash drive, it's probably in FAT, right?
Whatever. Some bullshit FAT.
Right? But HFS Plus stores everything in UTC except the volume creation date.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Fucking Apple.
So you need to know, like, somehow do all this research on everything, because you'll never know. That's my point of this, right?
You can never... No assumption. You can never make an assumption.
Don't ever assume it's in UTC. Don't ever assume it's local time. Figure it out. Right. Actually figure it out. Right?
Windows registry. No?
I mean, registry is a little bit weird, so this is the only big... This is the only part. So the folders are actually... They're called keys.
Right.
Right? So that is the only thing that stores a last write time. So
not
if I
the sub, not the
right,
actual
so
values.
Each individual...
So all the write times are lumped together for the parent folder.
Correct. So each individual D word or
D
whatever.
But that stands for double word.
Okay.
Which usually is... D words are 32 bits, usually.
Because right, it contains more... two of the eight...
Yeah, but no, it's not... The problem with saying
right?
word... No, it's a 32-bit number is...
What's 8 times 8?
64, right?
Is it 64? Okay. I'm not good at math. Remember,
I know you're bad.
More than happy to do it.
What's 8 times 4?
I don't know, dude.
32.
Okay, so why is it a double word then?
What's a word?
Yeah.
A word is the width of the processor that you're using.
Jesus Christ.
So that's like everything and nothing all at the same time. So a word is like the absolute worst metric.
Okay.
It's like if you thought metric system was cool and the imperial system was bad, fucking start measuring things in words and you'll fucking kill yourself.
Okay. Well, that's depressing, everybody.
So if you're like, a word, if you're in C++, this is something I deal with all the time. Like we haven't talked about what I'm doing for work, but if you just type int I, which is, I have an integer.
Okay.
Okay. The size of the integer mm-hmm. is based on the system you're compiling for. So if it's a 32-bit system, then it's a 32-bit long integer. If it's a 64-bit system, it's a 64-bit integer.
Okay.
So the way to actually lock down a width is to say int 32_t. It's like the most annoying thing to write. So all the source code I'm writing has, well, integers are unsigned, so uint. So I have uint 32t mm-hmm. everywhere.
Okay.
But if you have a number that you know is going to be small or reasonably small, mm-hmm. But you want it to be fast, mm-hmm. or going to be computed fast, you use a size T, which is the same thing as an int, but a size T explicitly says use the size of the microcontroller or of the processor or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's how many bits we want to use. And you use those for loops and stuff, because if you are adding numbers that are the size of the CPU, it's really easy. If you're adding a number that's half the size of the CPU, it has to add it mm-hmm. and then zero out the upper bit, so it's an extra instruction. Mm-hmm. And if you're adding something that's twice as big, you have to add the lower half, find the carry, add the upper half, add the carry bits.
Which reminds me, have you ever seen old vacuum tubes of the original like adding systems?
No.
They have a whole tube for the carry.
For the carry bit?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Dude, have you been to the computer museum?
Oh, definitely.
It's the cool... It's on 101 South from
here. Is it Mountain View or San Jose?
Oh my God, it's the coolest place ever.
Yep.
Yeah.
You should really go.
Definitely.
Sorry
if you're
in
California.
You know, Colorado or
yeah,
Nebraska
somewhere
or
else. Yeah, okay.
So sorry. But yeah, so the last write time is only appended to that key. So if I connect to a Wi-Fi network, right?
Right.
Usually one of the D words will be updated.
But you don't know which
and
one.
And that will update the last write time of that
parent.
Key. So you can only, like, so... people will ask me, like, was this file opened? I'm like, well, the last file that was in the thing was open at this time, but I don't know what time the other files were opened.
Right.
Why don't you know? Because that data
is
not stored.
Because Microsoft.
Yeah, Microsoft decided not to store that information. Sorry.
Sorry.
And there's a lot of other weird stuff, too, like...
But that's just the registry. That's not for files.
Correct.
The registry.
Yeah. But speaking of files...
MRU or what?
In here, so... starting with Windows Vista, they dropped the access time. So if I double click like a text file,
there's no more
and just look at it and then close it.
There's no record of that.
It won't actually store the last access time because they decided to do that for performance reasons.
Don't put double quotes, dude. The number one,
dude. That's like half of
the number one performance thing to do on Linux is, you know what FS tab is? Maybe that's where you put all your mounts. You put in no A time, meaning no access time. That's
how much time do you save?
Dude, tons. Imagine every file you open, you have to write to the disk. That's like saying for every...
You're writing like half a kilobyte of data.
Right, but no. You're writing like...
How...
4 bytes of data. Time.
Four bytes?
Four or 8 bytes. If it's a 64-bit, it's 8 bytes.
How small is that?
But you still have to queue a write. You still have to seek the hard drive over there. You still have to rewrite it. If it's one of those... What was the drive you sent me? The drive that used the... It was like the... What's the most terabytes we have right now? Do we have like a... 8 terabyte drive or something? Or
no. I mean, I have a 4 terabyte at work, and I thought that's the largest right now.
You sent me an article. You sent me a web page or a video about how they did this overriding on the tracks.
That's a shingled magnetic recording.
Right. So if you have shingles,
okay,
and you have to write even 4 bytes of data, you have to re-shingle all that shit.
That's a big hassle. But they did this way before SMR ever existed.
Right, so. But what I'm saying is that the majority of the time when you boot Windows,
I get what you're saying. If you boot Windows, it has every single file.
Every single file you read, you have to write back to the disk. That's like fucking ridiculous.
Okay. Well, that's ironic since everybody thought Vista was so slow. They implemented that.
Well, they probably had to take extreme measures, double air quotes. It's not single, it's double.
Okay.
They had to take extreme measures to compensate for the fact that Vista was a piece of shit, so.
Fair enough.
I don't know. Whatever you want me to say.
No, that's fine.
All right. So they turned off A time. So that makes you mad on Vista.
Well, it just gets rid of that forensic information, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's no longer a repository.
So in Linux,
it's important to know that if I'm looking in an XP system, I can expect access time to be accurate.
If you're looking at a Linux system,
Vista later,
Linux, you should expect access time to be accurate as well. Unless you can look in /etc/fstab.
Oh, Jesus.
And you look in there, and if it says no A time... then there's no access time. But if it doesn't say that, then by default, you'll have access time.
Gotcha.
So that's something to know.
Right. See? More research. It all comes down to research.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't just be guessing like, oh, it's access time. Okay. It should be fine.
Yeah, it's 1970, January 1st.
So what this is...
it says USB devices at the top of this slide.
Right. So I had a case in which it was one of those employee embezzlement things where the employee was plugged in a device into the work computer, which I'm not supposed to do, and downloaded a huge amount of proprietary information, then quits, starts his own company, and somehow knows how to do everything
perfectly. Edward Snowden kind of... Well, he didn't start his own company, but...
Right, but that sort of thing where you're, stealing a bunch of stuff. So clients asked me what devices were plugged into this computer during this time frame.
So you have all the USB UUIDs, right?
So here's the information you can get, right?
Device name, quick description.
So, look, iPhone, right? Because I had the iPhone backups, which I reconstructed all the text messages.
Okay,
right?
Good.
I was like, oh, that's fun. iPhone, let's see if there's a backup. Sure enough, there is.
Cool.
Right? You get a serial number for the device if it's provided. If it's not...
The manufacturer doesn't... Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Right. If it's not provided, interestingly enough, Windows will actually generate a unique number for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because that way, if you plug in 2 SanDisk devices that don't have a number, Microsoft needs to know, right, that you've plugged it in before. So it doesn't run the driver every single time.
But, so check it out. So I was working at Plantronics when I was like 16,
mm-hmm.
And the USB device number issue came up. Mm-hmm. So if Plantronics issues, let's see, what was it? They said that if they issued devices that all had the same serial number, which was very mm-hmm. cheap to manufacture because they didn't have to have a stage in the manufacturing where you flashed a unique serial number. Windows would not be able to tell the difference between every new USB port you plugged the headset into.
Mm-hmm.
It would reload all the drivers.
Oh Jesus!
So if you use the same USB port over and over, you were cool. But every new port, it would have to re-go through the driver search back on XP. So that's why unique serial numbers are better for a customer experience because Windows can track it between USB ports.
Right. So, I'm sure some of you remember plugging in a device in a different USB port.
And having like, it load that like, shit.
Wait, while we search for a driver, it's
and
like...
you're like, why? Well, I just was using
this. Are you kidding me? Like, yeah, figure
exactly.
it out,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
It's like, well, we would figure it out if your fucking manufacturer wasn't so goddamn lazy, basically.
Basically, right? It's exactly right.
So this is what they're interested in, the last unplugged date, which is, again, a Unix time, mm-hmm. converted in this awesome program, which is called USB Device View.
Cool.
USB DEV View. Uh-huh. I took the system file, copied it out of the forensic archive, then used a command line utility to pull
load
the
up.
Data from that,
load it up, yeah.
present it in here, and then put it in Photoshop and invert it to make it look cool.
Wow.
Yeah, that was the hardest part.
Wow.
And then so you can see the last unplugged time, and you can see like, okay, so this person plugged in an iPhone exactly this time, or plugged in this
well,
device.
Unplugged
containing,
it.
Right.
Which is... close to the plug-in time, hopefully, but...
theoretically.
Wait, if you restart, does that do anything?
It's the last write time, so it's probably the unplug time.
But I'm saying if you had an iPhone, mm-hmm. you plugged in the computer,
right.
then you restarted the computer, and while it was restarting, you unplugged it? Or like when it was at the BIOS, you unplugged it?
Mm. Yeah, that would then be the last plug-in time, because that would be the last time that it updated that key,
huh.
right? Because if you unplug okay. it, and it boots up the computer...
it would not be writing to it anymore. So you'd get the time before it had restarted. Probably.
Probably. But I wonder if it would update it again when it restarts and says, oh, there's
missing.
Nothing there. So let's update that as unplugged. In which case it would be inaccurate since you didn't unplug it when the computer started.
That's correct.
So you'd have to line it up with your device logs. Or the
something.
You know, event viewer. So that's what that's about. So it's cool to know that you can put things in this format. These guys love this. They're like, oh my god.
These fun. Guys?
Exactly.
The forensic guys?
My clients.
Clients
who are not forensic clients. Logs, don't worry about that.
Router logs.
Gets me to a long story. I had a robbery kidnapping case
mm-hmm.
where our client was accused of breaking into this house and holding this mother and child at gunpoint. And
did he at least, like, rape them for fun or anything?
No.
Or?
He was stealing guns from the master bedroom of the house.
Wow.
So this was in a very wealthy suburb in Contra Costa County.
Do they not defend themselves with their guns?
Well, no, because when they came into the house, they heard somebody ruffling through the, like, gun closet, basically. And they show up, and the guy's just, like, holds a gun at them and says, turn around, don't look at me, hand me all your jewelry, everything.
Wow.
And then go upstairs and don't even think about calling the cops, which, of course, they do the second that they leave. Cops show up, show a six-pack photo spread, and show them a...
What's a six-pack photo spread?
It's six photographs in, like, a booklet of known, like, criminals.
Okay.
Right? You know where they show you, like, those...
I've never been in that situation, but I could understand.
Sure.
Most recently used criminals.
So, okay. So if I show you six pictures of different types of fruits, and I say, what's your favorite fruit?
Yeah. I'm going to pick something on the list, more likely.
Probably. You okay. see peaches? I fucking love peaches.
Yeah.
Peaches are my favorite fruit.
But really, kiwi might be my really
favorite. Right. So what if I don't show you anything? What's your favorite fruit?
Kiwi.
You'd be like, oh, I like kiwis, man.
Yeah.
Star fruits are awesome.
Right.
Right? So they have to read you this thing called a Simmons admonishment.
Okay.
Which is, I'm going to show you six pictures of potential criminals. Just because I'm showing you these pictures doesn't mean that any of them are guilty or any of them are innocent. Doesn't mean anything. It just means... I'm showing you six.
Simmons was a dick. That doesn't work, man. You totally have bias. There's total bias
right.
with that.
That's the point, is to try to eliminate the bias, but, you know, good luck. So
right.
the woman points at a picture and says, I'm pretty sure it's that guy, 100%.
Right.
And the cop says, how do you know it's 100%? She says, the eyes. I know it's him.
Okay.
Okay. So they drive her over to the house, bang on the door like the police. You know what that's like, right, Ben?
No.
So
still no.
And say, you know, they ask the guy, what were you doing today? And he says, what do you mean? Like, he's wearing his pajamas. He's just like, I don't know.
He's in his refractory period.
He's hanging out. It's like 10 in the morning. He's like, dude, I was watching a Bruce Lee documentary and playing on my mom's computer and playing Words with Friends. And I don't know. That's it. Like, what do you mean? I was browsing the internet. I was watching this Bruce Lee documentary, basically. What are you talking about? He's like, were you holding a... Cop says, were you holding a handgun? Did you at any point go over to whatever the house is, a couple, like, four houses down?
That's
and
very close.
Pretty close. And so the guy says, dude, like, no way, I wasn't over there. What are you talking about? So, okay. So, goes back to the woman and says, like, does that look like the guy, like, in real life? And she says, I'm only 50% sure. But the cops got it in for him and says, sorry, I'm booking you for kidnapping and home invasion and robbery and all this bad stuff, right? Which is, that's pretty serious crimes,
Pretty serious shit.
That's a lot of felonies.
So wait, what? Okay, well, so this guy obviously had done something before, though.
Yeah, yeah. He's in the registry.
He's on the MRU.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. He was in for a lot of, like, marijuana charges, and this is a very wealthy, gated community suburb, so it's pretty easy to get on that list, you know, for something stupid.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of like a druggy kid, whatever, but not the type to hold people at gunpoint.
Okay.
Right? There's a difference.
Absolutely.
So I get the case, and I'm thinking, okay, we need to subpoena Zynga, makers of Words with Friends, and see if there's any, like, ad geolocation data that would prove that he's at home, right? Or maybe he was messaging with friends, and we can get timestamps, because chances are, if I'm in your house robbing you...
Game moves should have timestamps, right?
Exactly. Whatever I'm doing, there should be timestamps. If I'm robbing you, chances are I'm probably not playing Words with Friends at the same time that I'm holding you at gunpoint.
Chances are.
Right, but I could be that hardcore, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Who knows? But at the same time, even if I were, I would not be connected to my home Wi-Fi, so there's all these ways that I can use technology to identify where I was at a certain time.
Right.
Right? So I subpoena them. I then figure I'm going to subpoena Google and see if he was, if his phone was checking for email constantly using a Fetch or whatever, whatever it was.
Whatever, yeah.
If that's the case, the IP address used to check that should be logged with Google. But I also need the IP address from his home address to make sure that that's, that can also be included in my subpoena.
Or whatever, yeah.
So I go over to their house, grab their router, you know, and I connect to their Wi-Fi, connect to everything, and I download all the router logs and identify their IP address. And I include that in my subpoena.
Right.
So I subpoena Google. They give me a really hard time with the Stored Communications Act, which basically says that any large ISP is not required to
store every packet.
Well, they store it, but they're not required to turn it over to me. They're only allowed to give it to law enforcement. It's sort of
But aren't you acting in the benefit of law enforcement? I mean,
sort of.
The law enforcement were the ones that... They didn't ask you to do this, but they arrested him and said, okay, now let's figure out what to do with this guy.
Right, but since I don't work for the cops, I work for... In this case, I'm working privately retained for...
Right, privately retained. Exactly, right.
So, fortunately, as an independent expert, I don't have to... It doesn't matter what I find, right? I don't have a bias. I just find whatever is there, and it's all mathematically verifiable.
Right.
So, you know, if I find out that you are, in fact, screwed... Guess what?
You're screwed.
You're screwed.
Right.
Whether I like it or not, whether, you know, you're going to pay me one way or another.
Right.
Sorry. So I need to get the logs for that reason, also to find out whether or not there was activity. According to Comcast, I subpoenaed them to get the TV records to be able to prove that he was watching the documentary that he said that he was watching.
Uh-huh.
And also just to see if there was any network activity. Right. Comcast has what's called an always-on connection.
Okay.
They don't actually keep logs of what you're searching or anything
at all. Or what you're watching.
Correct.
But does your cable modem,
apparently it's just all, they just have a
they
direct.
They stream you everything, right?
Exactly.
Yeah,
they do not keep any records whatsoever.
Right.
Which makes sense. If they're not federally required to keep those logs, they usually won't, because it's an extra overhead that they don't want
to
keep.
The money they have to spend, basically.
Right. Yeah. Like, why would they want to have hundreds and hundreds of extra servers to store everybody's information?
Right.
When it doesn't benefit them economically in any way. Shareholders would probably say, what the hell are you doing with this whole server in Norway storing everybody's internet history?
Right.
What the fuck? Get rid of it. Save us some money. Right? This is metadata from a standard iPhone 4S running iOS 7 something or other. I have arrows pointing towards it.
Yeah.
So this particular phone has like every single thing. I pulled this from a friend's phone. And a picture that somebody had MMS'd me. So if somebody MMS's you a picture, you can pull all this EXIF data from it and just check out all this stuff.
So it has, not only does it have GPS, but it also has the direction you were facing.
Mm-hmm.
True north, 35.39 degrees.
It's a lot of information. And I can tell, I pulled a friend's information once, and check out that part right there where it says last...
Last power up.
Runtime since power up. Hers said 17 days.
Yeah.
I said restart your phone.
Yeah, restart it.
And she's like, what do you mean? And it was a couple days after she sent me the picture, because I was preparing this presentation. I said, you have not restarted your phone in 19 days. She's like, how do you know? Like, because for some reason, picture data stores the last runtime since power up.
Stupid. Well, what, it's not stupid. It's
what reason could you possibly have for that?
It's called future proofing. Like, you put extra data in if it doesn't cost. This data doesn't really cost you.
It doesn't cost anything, hardly.
Right, so you put it in just because maybe you'll use it in the future.
Can you think of a conceivable reason why?
I can't, but if they fucking throw in everything, including the kitchen sink, like, why not?
I guess. It's a forensic gold mine, for Christ's sakes.
Yeah.
So some of these things will include, it'll tell you whether it's UTC or not. I can tell what phone it was taken from, right? I can tell this is the date right here. Sometimes it's called original creation date. Like, there's lots of different EXIF versions per phone.
Because EXIF must just be like key value, right? It's not like, that looks like key value. That's it. That's all it is. That means that there's a key and a value. That's all that means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. Sometimes it'll tell you that it has a negative, like an offset. But it's kind of confusing because it'll tell you the time and then it'll say -7:00:00. But you don't know if it's applying it or telling you to apply it.
Right.
Right? So you have to do your own test yet again to figure out what the hell it means. So anyway, but that's kind of a staggering amount of information just for a standardized picture, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But when you consider how much a normal phone does when you take a picture and it runs it through lossy compression, all of this stuff, and then writes it to disk, all in like a fraction of a second.
Yeah.
That's a lot of stuff.
It is a lot of stuff.
Right? I agree. This is nothing. This is like the very...
I mean, that's like the tip of the spear. That's just the fucking text file that's at the beginning of the JPEG.
But for us mere humans, it looks like a lot of stuff, right?
Well, yeah.
Exactly. So, that's it.
Cool, dude. So, that's a good presentation. Thank you, Sam.
Any old time.
Is there like other stuff you want to touch on? We've been running...
Kind of been a minute.
For an hour and 27 minutes.
Yeah. Long podcast. I don't know.
I can tell you about my work a little bit.
I'd love to hear about your work.
Let's do so it. I'm working for a company. We're trying to build a new Internet of Things technology. I know that sounds like super buzzword, super buzzwordy.
But it's true.
But we're building a... all that cellular means, it just means that you have base stations.
Yep. And cell.
It's a cell, which is literally a circle around the base station. That's what the cell means. It's the radius that you can communicate with that base station. Mm-hmm. And then there's multiple, so cellular. And as you drive, it hops cells, right? So we are building a cellular low data rate network. There is...
By the way, how low?
10 bytes a second.
That's right. 10 bytes. That's not kilobytes, no. By the way.
That's slower than dial-up. That's like way slower than dial-up.
Yeah. We're taking you way back to 1980.
19 ever? Because I don't think anybody ever had that kind of dial-up.
My 2400 baud modem, I could download at the rate of a maximum.
Wait. 2400 baud. Okay, let's figure this out, okay?
By all means.
Okay, by all means.
Trust me, I had this modem for a long time. It was very traumatic.
All right, so 2400 baud, okay.
I went straight from 2400 to 14.4, and let me tell you, that was the fastest, that was the most epic upgrade of all time.
Okay, that's 300 bytes a second. We're at 10.
300 bytes?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Positive.
So what is a 300 baud modem?
A 300 baud modem?
Yeah, I think the slowest modem that AOL would recognize was a 300 baud modem.
That's 37 bytes, 37 and a half bytes a second.
Holy crap.
Okay.
All right, so my 2400 baud modem was how many times faster than your network?
300 divided by 10, so 30 times.
Okay, so my modem from the 90s, got it.
Okay.
Continue.
So the application here is not YouTube. It's not sending MP3s or whatever. You could text with this. You could check your emails with it. But
text would actually have a lag.
Right, quite absolutely.
Yeah.
Because every 10 characters, a byte is a character, so every 10 characters would take a second. So don't fucking write long text messages and expect them to go quickly.
Yeah, none of those wall of texts about your girlfriend, your breakup, nobody wants to hear that last thing.
You'll be penalized if you try to send that.
You will be punished.
So we're designing it for M2M, which means machine to machine, which basically just means, like, I have a sense. I'm not a human. I have some sensor that's sensing humidity or temperature.
Right.
Or maybe, for instance, I want to put a radio in every light bulb and light switch, so then you can turn on light switches.
Right.
So if you think about that, 10 bytes a second.
That's plenty of data.
For a light switch, right?
Exactly.
In fact,
is the light switch
if you say
on?
10 bytes, that is 80 bits. Mm-hmm. So if it's a single bit to turn the light switch on and off, that's 0.01 seconds to turn the light switch on and off, which is like, that's great.
Very fast.
That's totally fast. Like, that's all you need.
By the way, the original modems from back in the day, they used to be able to display with the BBS days, bulletin board service, for those of you who are not old enough.
Yeah.
Like you, Ben.
Yeah.
You never used a BBS, did
no,
you?
No. We had MUDs, but no BBSs.
Okay. Well, I did, but only very briefly because I was like 11 years old.
Right. Anyway. You weren't old enough, long enough yet.
Right. But I remember connecting to a BBS, and I read later on that, like, they could display, I think it was 80 characters a second. When you think about it, you can't read 80 characters a second.
Right.
So that's plenty of
That's plenty.
Tons of bandwidth.
Right,
it's all text. Like, what the hell are you going to... Why would you need more speed than that?
Right, exactly.
Exactly. But nobody even thought of an image, because all you had was a green screen with, like...
Yeah, well, how the only image could be ASCII, and that could be represented in 8 characters per second, right?
Exactly.
So, yeah, that's really funny. So, basically, my job... I'm a founder of this company, and my job is to build the client radios as well as the base station software. So right now we're running Linux.
But you guys are using a spectrum of FM bandwidth?
So we're using what's called unlicensed spectrum. Mm-hmm. It's what you would use for your cordless phones that your mom had, right? Baby monitors, all that stuff.
Right.
So unlicensed spectrum...
Sort of short range.
Yeah, right. For them. For us it's not short range, but for them it is.
Right.
Unlicensed spectrum basically means that you're fighting with other people. The FCC, I haven't read it myself, but the FCC spec says something like, you must not cause interference with other devices.
Right.
There's another provision in there that says you have to channel hop. And a channel is basically like a piece of the spectrum.
Right.
So you can't transmit on a single channel for too long. You have to hop around, all that stuff.
So your device has to be synced with the base station, synced to hop accordingly.
Right.
So
right.
As I understand it, there's like a chip that you guys both pick an algorithm, a seed, right?
Right.
And you
go through the sequence.
Choose,
it's a sequence, yeah.
And then everything needs to be synced up exactly.
Exactly.
So my question is, what happens when something gets out of line? How does it detect that, wait?
So if you power off the device and power it on, so we haven't gotten to a lot of that stuff yet. We're still trying to get range and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the general idea is you have a kind of a, it's called a broadcast channel.
Mm-hmm.
So when the device turns on, it doesn't know what time it is. It doesn't know anything. Mm-hmm. So it broadcasts out on the broadcast channel. And the base station replies with a time, UTC time,
mm-hmm.
as well as either a hopping sequence or a channel allocation or something like that to be determined. Okay. And the device will record that in RAM and then hold on to it. As long as it's powered on, it holds on to this.
Right.
And so it knows what time it is because it has its own internal clock running. And then it does its own transmission. So basically, it's given a time slot. So
isn't its own internal clock slightly off?
Okay, so this is a huge, huge issue. So you think it's wrong. You think it's an issue because you're transmitting at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
But in actuality, it's an issue because your frequency is wrong. So your frequency is based on your clock. So basically... We have, on this specific chip, we have a 32 megahertz clock.
Okay.
But we're transmitting at 915 megahertz. So how does that work?
915 megahertz?
Right.
Okay.
So you might think to yourself, well, how is it possible to get something faster, a clock faster than you have?
I would think that you would, the 915, you would downclock it. Whatever.
So you can upclock.
Underclock it, I guess.
You can overclock without actually changing the speed of the clock.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a faster clock using some circuitry. It's called a PLL. It's called a phase lock loop. It's super complicated. But basically what you do is you have... So the benefit of a crystal, it's literally a crystal oscillator. It's literally quartz,
right.
Like the mineral quartz,
mm-hmm.
Tied with two wires on the side. And you send a pulse of energy at it,
mm-hmm.
and it oscillates at its frequency. So
and
depending,
it's constant.
It's constant. It's there is jitter. Mm-hmm. Well, it's constant at a certain temperature, but you change the temperature, it changes.
I guess my question is, it's always...
Well, let me finish, all right? Okay, so you have this crystal, literally a rock in a package, in mm-hmm. a plastic package that you install on your circuit board, okay. and the chip sends a pulse of electricity at it and literally boots the clock, and the clock starts oscillating at its own internal frequency. Mm-hmm. Okay, so on the chip, there's something called a PLL, which is basically, it's a voltage-controlled oscillator. So it's an oscillator where you give it a voltage, and it outputs an oscillation. But voltage-controlled, or VCOs, voltage-controlled oscillators, are very inaccurate. Mm-hmm. So you need to base the VCO on the crystal. Mm-hmm. Okay? And basically, I don't exactly understand it, but you're able to multiply and divide the crystal such that you are... Basically, if you say, well, we want... Instead of 32 megahertz, we want 64. Well, you can change the voltage on this oscillator until you get two edges for every single edge of the crystal.
Okay.
So you reference your VCO to the real crystal, which actually will maintain actual time.
Okay.
So there's a PLL. The PLL has to lock. So there's a time where the PLL is locking, where it literally tries to find its own frequency and whatever. So you measure these things in parts per million.
Sounds like a lot of soul searching.
Yeah, it's a lot of code. You measure how far you're off in parts per million. Mm-hmm. So we would like to be tolerant within one part per million. That's like kind of our goal. And that will affect how off you are on your 915. Are you 915.000 or your 915.001? Like, what's your actual frequency?
Wow.
So you have a couple, there's a lot of... So, okay, so the base stations, what we're using is we're using GPS-disciplined base stations. So the base stations all have a GPS chip in them, which gives us the real second, I'm using air quotes, the second that the world uses. Hell no, what's going on? So the actual second starts when all the base stations know they all have the same second. And since the GPS is coming down from space, it's all we can assume that it's the same second
okay.
in actuality. Okay. So you literally have to discipline the clock of the tracker device based on the base station. Mm-hmm. So there's tons of ways to do it. You can have the base station listen to the wave that the tracker emits and then measure it and then transmit back, oh, by the way, you're off by this much, right? But in order to if the tracker is really, really off, you have to detune your own clock to the clock that the tracker's operating on. Transmit a message to say, hey, you're way off. Your clock is way off. And then go back to zero. So there's a lot of clock. Clocks are like one of the biggest things involved. And I said that you have a 32 megahertz clock, right? But every edge is not exactly at 32 megahertz. On average, it's at 32 megahertz, but each edge has what's called jitter, which means it's slightly faster or slower. Mm-hmm. And so jitter adds noise into your signal. So if you have a clock with really bad jitter, every single 32 megahertz edge is like inaccurate. And so that affects the transmission that you're making. It kind of like smudges the signal. Mm-hmm. So you want very low jitter. So like the amount of, we're talking about standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yep.
The amount of things that we're doing to get long range is like ridiculous. But a lot of it's been written in papers before. So it's cool because you can like, read error up on correction. The paper. Forward error correction is one of them. Lots of stuff.
Error correction is in everything, right?
Wi-Fi has it. Hard drives have it.
CDs
have it. Yeah, forward error correction for CDs is that basically you record extra data so that if you lose some of it, you can CRC your way back to the original message.
Oh, like really fast.
Well, yeah. I mean, they all have hardware implementations, but yeah, real time.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, you think about it, a CD is a microscopic laser
right.
reading those bits, but somehow you can drive and listen to a CD
with vibrations.
The whole CD, and you're
right.
banging over potholes, and somehow it keeps playing, skips
yeah.
only every once in a while. How the hell is that possible?
Yeah.
Can you even like hold your coffee like perfectly still?
No, I don't
think so.
But you also have to realize, though, that error correction, forward error correction, only works to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you, for every 8 bits, you encode an extra 2 bits, that's an 8-10 ratio, so that will get you like you can correct like 1 or 2 bits of error, okay? Mm-hmm. But if you imagine recording double, so if you had 8 to 16,
right.
you could correct, I guess, up to 7 or 8 bits of error.
Sure.
But beyond that, you're fucked, right?
And so every time you add more of that, you're obviously taking up more space.
You're taking more space on the medium.
So, you know, that's why you can have a CD that can be 800 megabytes or 650 megabytes.
I don't think that's the reason. I think the reason is because they made the tracks longer.
There is that, but they kept shrinking them. Sony made their own version
of it. Oh, they would shrink the tracks shorter and shorter and shorter
until...
Right,
get rid of more or less error correction. Like, it's been a sliding sort of scale, right?
Well, it's a knob you can turn.
Interesting.
But the thing about CDs is you can scratch them a little bit and they still play perfectly. You scratch them a little bit more and they still play perfectly. And you scratch them a tiny bit more and it goes to shit. It skips all over. But that's because you've hit the error threshold on your forward error correction. So yeah, clock recovery is like a big thing that I'm working on.
Alright.
Yeah.
Where does that leave us?
That leaves us, I think, at the end. I think I'm ready to get out of here, man. It's been a good podcast. We learned a lot of shit.
Definitely.
Hope you guys learned some shit. And who knows if we'll ever podcast soon or again. I apologize for the break. That's my fault. Merrick is, who knows what the fuck Merrick's doing.
Is it your fault?
It is my fault because I'm super busy. I never get you guys together. So.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I thought it was my fault.
Well, it's my fault.
Good.
All right. Anyways, we'll see you guys later.